At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. Today, we are so excited because it is our first episode where we have a special guest that is outside of our Farm to Table team. So we have Dr. Cheryl Burdett with us, and she is a clinician that is a naturopathic physician. So we have not had a lot of blog posts or anything about naturopathic medicine. So she'll have to clue us in on some of that and her background and training as we talk. So I'm going to give you a little bit of bio of her. She's the founder of Personal Logic Health Academy, an educational initiative designed to increase knowledge of integrative medicine for practitioners. She is also the director of education and the naturopathic residency program at Progressive Medical. And she's the founder and educational director of a functional laboratory called Precision Point Diagnostics, which is how we connected, and for which she designs clinical profiles and trains clinicians with utilization. And she is on the board of advisors for Zymogen, and she is a partner in Theradura, a physician line distributed in Germany, and currently serves on IRB boards involved in clinical studies and translational research and has lectured worldwide. So we're so happy that she was able to give us some of her time today, because I think she's leaving soon out of the country. Her passion includes teaching and practicing integrative and functional medicine and naturopathic medicine, and to really increase the awareness of evidence-based natural therapies. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Burdett. And then we also have Dr. Jessica Orlowski, who is one of our pharmacists on the Farm to Table team here. And you guys have heard from her if you've been listening to the podcast before. So we're so excited. Today we're going to talk about allergies. So Jessica, tell me what's happening in your pharmacy as far as allergies. You're in Pennsylvania. Like, what are people coming in and asking questions about?
So right now it's seasonal allergy time. You know, we see so many patients with the changes of the seasons, and whether it's like it all over the country, but here it'll be cold one day, warm the next day, and it really wreaks havoc on people's allergies and sinuses. And so we constantly, at least I would say a handful of patients, like I can count on a hand, like five a day at least, from kids to adults with allergies, worsening allergies, people saying, I've never had allergies before and now I don't know what to do. So it is something that I think is really good information to put this podcast out for.
Yes, yes. And it's the sixth leading cause of chronic illness in the United States. So not only is it increasing, but it's like getting up there with all of these other chronic diseases. And so often I think we don't even classify it in our minds as a chronic illness. We're just like, oh, I'm dealing with allergies. Everybody has them, that they forget that there might be a path to really getting better and reducing those allergies or preventing the development of allergies. So allergy is really related to the development of human society. So this living environment and lifestyle that we have is predominantly urbanized, industrial living environments. We've got lots of hygiene products. We've used lots of antibiotics that disrupt our microbiome. We've got this sedentary lifestyle, but also like over-sanitized lifestyle, lots of fast food, which affects our microbiome. So all of this really reduces those microbial diversities in our gut. So that's really why we're here talking about it. Dr. Brett, what would you say is the reason why this is a topic that you love to talk about?
Well, you definitely are speaking to it. I think the first part is that there's so much that we can do to shift it. People just aren't stuck in place. They don't have to just continue to react to whatever's in their environment. And the second piece is helping them to understand how it connects to the entire body. And so you spoke a little bit to the microbiome. And so what we know is that in the past 40 years, we've just seen a radical escalation of allergies. And then the literature is pretty clear that that is because of environmental toxicity. And so maybe not as clear as to all of the causes, causes. I think that that's a big piece of it. But like you mentioned, where are we getting these environmental toxins? And it's not just things that industry puts out into the environment, but also, as you mentioned, the food that we are eating. And in these changes that have happened are dramatic and in such a short time that you really can't write them off to something genetic. It has to be something more environmental that's affecting us this way. And alongside with the same increase in allergies, you see an increase in asthma, an increase in autoimmunity, and all of these things are part of that same piece of the immune system. So it happens when our immune system begins to get confused. And I think that we can draw from what we know in terms of breastfeeding to really kind of understand this a bit more. So what we know is that we would like every kiddo to have an opportunity to breastfeed if they can. It doesn't always work out, but we know if possible that that's one of those fundamental things that really gives us a healthy microbiome. And then when we look from there, we know that that is associated with a decrease in allergies, a decrease in food sensitivities, a decrease in asthma and autoimmune conditions. And why? Well, the reason for that is it helps to set up that health the microbiome. And the microbiome is the flora in the gut. And we learn things like there's more bacteria in the gut than there are stars in the Milky Way. And that we're really seeing this change. And if you look at people with allergies, for example, compared to those that don't react as much, you can see a very different setup of local ecology there in the gut of all that bacteria. And so that microbiome has to be intact in order to prime the immune system. So what we know is, for example, 85% of the immune system is in the gut. And this breaks down a couple of ways. First of all, there's a layer there called secretory IgA. And that is before anything even gets into the body, that's going to have more exposure to proteins in a single day than our systemic immune system sees in a lifetime. So as you mentioned, if we're breathing in lots of, I was blown away. I don't think this is the biggest one that we're worried about, but I remember 20 years ago when I was on my honeymoon in Spain, something on the radio talked about parts per million of cocaine in the air. And so I was like, wow, that's shocking. But I don't think that that's, you know, our biggest deal exactly. But if that even exists, that tells you how likely it is that parts per million of exhaust and parts per million of other solvents, and then we get down to water and microplastics and the medications that are in them. So all of that assault, and then also the assault from the foods we eat, medications we take, and just simply put, stress. If you want to build a less healthy gut ecology, then you hang out in a state of stress. And that means you are in fight or flight. You are not in rest and digest. And that rest and digest is when we get good blood flow to the gut and really nourish this microbiome. So you can see all of those pieces really set us up for a compromised microbiome. And that is the major thing that tells the immune system, no, this is normal. We shouldn't react to this. Or, we're under attack. There's something foreign about this. Ramp up immune function. And that will cause a change in how our immune system recognizes things.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that's awesome to get back to sort of the basics of what the GI system is doing. So we've got this lymphoid tissue, we've got B cells and T cells and phagocytes, and all of that is really helping our body to become tolerant to things. And we should not have this immune reaction when we first eat something. So that if we think about babies and when they're born, their cells aren't this tight junction, like they become tight later as they start to nurse and get those nutrients and get those good microbiome elements from mom. And so when they have this like almost leaky gut they're born with, and then they start all these extra proteins that they might be receiving through breast milk or through just exposure in the environment, or when they start eating solid foods, if that gut really doesn't get the foundational connection from all this microbiome and this matrix of microflora, that's when we really start to see this increase of this immune reaction when those babies start to eat foods. It's interesting because I get a lot of questions about that, and I don't know from your perspective, when you're treating a baby for allergies, does that make you say, hey, mom, we need to address like your gut at all as far as like what could be going on there? Do we think like most moms with like allergy babies have some kind of intestinal hyperpermeability, or what are your thoughts there?
So I think you're spot on. We know for sure that every kiddo comes onto this planet with a leaky gut. And so that leaky gut that you mentioned, normally we should have a barrier that's intact. And so if that's when that occurs, foods come into the system and they are broken down by that barrier into micronutrients that the body can use. But if the gut is leaky, as you mentioned, and this is how all kiddos start, then things leak through intact. Now, rather than them being broken down into simple pieces, the immune system says, I don't recognize that. That's foreign. And it begins to create an antibody response. These antibodies are the beginning of allergies. They can tell cells that released histamine, known as mast cells or basophils, to burst open. And so depends on where that cell is, what symptom you'll get. If it happens, you know, in your nose and you're going to get a runny nose. If it happens in the eyes, itchy eyes. But if it happens to be happening in the gut, then this could be gas or bloating. Interestingly, though, when we think about histamine, we think about runny nose, runny eyes kind of piece, but we have plenty of histamine receptors in the brain. So it can be associated with brain fog, depression. Even certain types of schizophrenia are defined by the amount of histamine that's made. We have histamine receptors on the heart. So I've seen really interesting things where we change the histaminergic load by working on that gut and seeing things like arrhythmia go into remission. So histamine, unfortunately, is something that can trigger various symptoms throughout the body, not just this seasonal part. And so it can get confusing for people because it can be hard to link together. So kiddos, start off with that gut that's more leaky. And the whole idea of breastfeeding is to give the gut time to heal. And there are a lot of things in breast milk that help with this as well. Various immunoglobulins that allow the immune system to build to increase that secretory IgA that nurture that microbiome. And so it's very interesting what you're seeing is that with this increase in allergies, the recommendation from the Journal of Pediatrics probably about 2 to 3 years ago at this point was actually that we should start introducing food earlier, not later. And I find that fascinating because normally you think if more people are reacting, let's wait and wait and wait until we introduce it so we can make sure the gut is intact. But what we're seeing is that if introduced with breast milk, then that is a signal to those immune cells in the gut, those Peyer's patches that are part of that, the lymphoid tissue that you mentioned there in the gut. And it says, oh, I see the food. I see the right immune signaling. This must be normal. And that helps with auto tolerance. So I think that we can also learn from that and borrow from that clinically. If breast milk tells the gut to be less leaky, if breast milk presents the body with immune signals that cause us to not react to foods, how can we mimic that? Mm-hmm. So I've become a very big fan of using immunoglobulins. You can get colostrum-based immunoglobulins, sure. Serum-based, some that are egg-based. But when utilizing these immunoglobulins, what I see is that in particular, food sensitivities and food sensitivity testing improve much more than historically I've seen it. Certainly, I'm a long-term recommender of glutamines and probiotics and things like that that will also play a role. And we'll probably talk more about. But as I started introducing immunoglobulins, recognizing that this sets up the immune signaling a lot like breast milk, what I started to see was less reactivity. So that's the good news. We can prime the immune system. And if we missed out on the opportunity or if other things set us up to create this immune confusion, then again, it doesn't mean that that's permanent. If it were permanent, strategies like desensitization or sublingual immunotherapy wouldn't work. We know we can change what the immune system does, and that's one way. Working on gut-based health is another way to calm down immune confusion and reactions.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I wonder, back to the question of if these patients moms are breastfeeding. A lot of moms I've had, you know, say, okay, well, baby's reacting mm-hmm. to soy mm-hmm. or dairy that I'm eating. And that happened to me too. So in a way, it's almost like mom's not breaking it down like she should and getting into the micronutrients and getting those into the smaller form in the bloodstream. So there's probably some element of larger proteins in her bloodstream if baby's really reacting to that, don't you think?
So I think the main thing that then gets passed in the breast milk is not the complex of immunoglobulin in food. That's a little bit larger, and that's not what we'd see as much. But of course, it creates histamine, it creates cytokines, it creates inflammatory mediators, and you do pass those inflammatory mediators along.
Okay.
Second piece is that, at least initially, and you know, it's just fascinating, one of the things that breast milk is particularly high in is an enzyme called diamine oxidase. And it's the enzyme that degrades histamine. And the reason for that is normally we produce this in the gut lining, but if you happen to be pregnant, your placenta makes huge amounts of the enzyme that degrades histamine. And the reason for this is that we have to control this inflammation from histamine to even make it on planet Earth. So it's so irritating that if we don't do this well, it can create a miscarriage in the most extreme form. So you birth baby, you birth placenta, and then after that, your levels of diamine oxidase stay so high in the blood, and then therefore the breast milk, that passing an enzyme that degrades histamine is literally a part of setting up the microbiome, and so points to that. So in that case, if mom is reacting to foods, pulling mom off those foods should lower the inflammation and should create less of a colicky situation in kiddo. We probably, you know, it depends on where you are in terms of the breastfeeding and the food introduction. If foods haven't been introduced at all yet, then we're assuming that that's not an issue for colic in baby. And so more, it's reducing that inflammatory load in mom. But along those lines, babies that have less, so first, you get it from mom, the diamine oxidase that degrades histamine. Second is that helps you to set up your own gut so that you begin to make it on your own. And what studies say is that babies that have less production of diamine oxidase are more likely to be our colicky kiddos. So it could be from mom and her food allergies and sensitivities. It could also be a lack of production of diamine oxidase. And diamine oxidase is something that we can also take orally. So in cases like that, often have mom increase her diamine oxidase, increase her fish oils. Fish oils are just sucked up by the brain of baby, but they also make the membrane around the cells that release histamine thicker so they don't burst open and produce as much histamine.
That's super interesting because I have done my DNA, you know, 23andMe thing and run it through some different things and have found that I have a mutation that causes less diamine oxidase and I have had two colicky babies. So this is all wish I would have known right then. Certainly I pulled out foods and worked with probiotics, but I didn't really think about supplementing with that at that time because I didn't know as much about all of this. So that's really helpful for the moms out there listening or the expecting moms.
What you did was completely right because probiotics will nurture your own microvilli, the little fingertips of the lining of the gut. And that's where you make diamine oxidase. So the things that you did helped you to produce your own. You're on track.
Sure.
Sometimes we can get a faster response by taking it, but fish oils, probiotics, everything we do to treat a leaky gut, not only puts that barrier intact, but makes the microvilli plump up. And when they plump up, they produce more of this enzyme. So, so absolutely, those were good strategies.
Awesome. And then we have breastfeeding as a key factor. We know that we have low breastfeeding rates across the globe, especially in our industrialized nations where formula is typically recommended. And now that we have a formula shortage, we may see increased breastfeeding, especially in new moms. Certainly they can't go back and make that decision as easily, but new parents might say, well, I might not be able to get this. So maybe I should try the breastfeeding piece. But other than that, some of the other things that contribute to deciding if someone's more at risk for allergies or not, one of the things is early life antibiotic exposure. So if patients had antibiotic exposure, especially in that first few months or first few years of life, especially the first year, they certainly can have more risk because of that disruption of the microbiome. So is there anything else either of you want to add about that?
Well, I think it's just, it's good to be mindful that sometimes they're necessary. I mean, if you get a strep throat, you know, we really want to treat that with antibiotics because the potential is to, if that's left unchecked, it can even damage the heart. Sometimes they are for sure necessary, but if that's the case, then coming behind it with some type of probiotic, one formulated for a kiddo, often Saccharomyces is a strain that's recommended because it will help particularly with the diet. death that occurs from an antibiotic. So we're able to manage these things and not have to choose kind of, well, shall I let this ear infection run rampant or worry about the microbiome? We're able to kind of balance these things.
Yeah, for sure.
Second is that if somebody is seeing constant chronic infections where they tend to need an antibiotic more and more, and ear infections in kiddos is one that happens to be more common, then what's putting the burden on the immune system in the first place? And that can often be foods that one is allergic or sensitive to. And so figuring that out and getting rid of the food that's confusing the immune system and wearing the immune system down by causing it to fight a food instead of a bug is quite useful. And if you have a kiddo who gets lots of ear infections, that's a great way to help them. In the meantime, limit dairy, limit orange and bananas. Those are all things, dairy the most, that cause us to make more mucus. And studies have shown that dairy sensitivities can be related to much as 60 to 80% of chronic ear infections, so otitis media.
Wow. That's interesting. I know we always talk about taking dairy out when you're sick and things, and but for certainly for even, would you say most like allergy patients, if they're having a lot of rhinitis and stuffiness, mm-hmm. that they should avoid dairy too?
Mm-hmm, dairy. And I mean, think, you know, most kiddos, like when they get sick and we're going to say, oh, let's give them some orange juice.
Right.
But it turns out first, oranges are mucogenic. They cause us to produce more mucus. And then if it's not an orange, it might be a banana. Those two are mucus formers. Second, it turns out, and I just remember the first time I learned this, I was blown away. The sugar in the orange juice, even though there's vitamin C there, it's so much trumped by the amount of sugar that there's actually an immune suppression for the next 3 hours after that orange juice. So
wow.
These things that we think that, okay, or we're going to really help out here, we kind of need to think again about.
Yeah.
Just some peppermint tea might be a better idea.
Right. If you can get that 3-year-old to drink some peppermint tea. For adults, yes. But yeah, that's interesting because I think so often we're led to believe by like media articles and milk does a body good and orange juice get your vitamin C serving and all of these things that those things are real. And orange juice has a ton of fructose in it too, which we have a lot of data that that's dangerous from a metabolic system standpoint too. Probably not as much for young kids. So those would be really good things to think about avoiding in those kids that may be struggling with their immune function. All right. Any other things that we want to talk about on those topics as far as early life?
I was just going to kind of ask you, Dr. Burdett, you know, we're talking so much about gut health and, you know, how the mom can pass her gut health to baby, even if it is born, the baby's born cesarean or vaginally, how important it is for the baby's microbiome to be super strong. And I've had this question come up a lot. Do you recommend a probiotic in pregnant women? Well, just kind of baseline, or a probiotic in a baby once it's born, if they know that they're not going to be breastfed?
Yeah. So I think a probiotic when one is pregnant makes a lot of good sense. Interestingly, a better microbiome in your GI tract influences your vaginal flora. And the vaginal flora is a large part of where baby gets their microbiome when they're born vaginally. So interesting point with a C-section is the microbiome can be more compromised because they didn't get that exposure. It's not the only place. I think we're starting to see some data now that bits of bacteria, that placenta is not as iron clad as we thought. And so if a mom, you know, needed a C-section, then they shouldn't feel like, oh no, everything for the microbiome is totally messed up. Also, once baby comes out, just the suckling on our skin and being close to us is another place that they'll develop their microbiome. But yes, that probiotic before influences the vaginal microbiome. So it does help baby when they're born to get the right flora. And like we see this with probiotics, they've even, you know, even yogurt, they've done studies with showing women who eat yogurt have different vaginal flora. They're less likely to get yeast infections than those who don't. And so, of course, the yogurt is not going directly to the vagina. Those two things aren't directly connected like a tube there, but it shows how the microbiome one place influences the microbiome in the other place. Your question, should a kiddo get a probiotic? This is one that we have tossed back and forth for years. And sometimes you would hear the idea that a probiotic in a baby might not be the right thing to do, because if that gut is still leaky, will that flora leak through intact, and will that be dangerous? And so we can, again, turn to the Journal of Pediatrics for this answer. Maybe a year or two, maybe more than that by now, maybe 4 years ago, they've really changed their stance on that. And the data says, even if you're born as a neonate, even if you're born early, you are less likely to die if you receive a probiotic than if you don't. And so I think that that data is pretty clear. If you're born early, it helps survival. And then just normal term birth, again, still, you know, we look at what's going on with the escalation of allergies and sensitivities, and it does make sense to do things to influence that microbiome. Now, again, I would still, if I had to pick, I would put breastfeeding first. It's like, it's just, it is the thing designed for a healthy microbiome, but a probiotic in there can't hurt. And like you said, especially if breastfeeding is not as much of an option for one reason or another.
Yes, I always recommend it to my patients too. And there's some specific probiotics that are focused on those women's flora strains that would be in the vaginal tissue. So those can be great ones to take during pregnancy. And we can link a couple of those in the show notes. And then I personally have used with patients and myself those same strains with baby in the early parts of the weeks, and then switching over to like an infant blend, which some of the strains are pretty similar to the infant blend recommendations. But I think for my, and I have an N of two here where one child, I didn't know all of this information. And then the second child I did, and the second child did much better with the food allergy, you know, no food allergies and immune craziness like the first child. So I think it again, my N of two isn't strong enough to make any big clinical decisions, but for us, it made a big difference in that course for him. So, all right. Especially cause I had to get antibiotics for group B strep early, right before delivery. So I was like, all right, we need probiotics right now. So we can talk a little bit about like maternal influencing factors for the development of allergic disease. So we talked about the things, I don't know, Jess, do you want to talk about this? I know you're passionate about women and women's health and pregnancy and postpartum. Do you want to go over that section, the maternal factors for development of allergic disease in infants?
Sure. So we did mention some maternal factors like the mom's gut health, you know, kind of, are we kind of behind in passing it to our kids and causing these issues? But fortunately there, we talked how we can help them. Factors that the mom can bring that increase the risk of asthma in infants could be like if a mom has any chronic infections, if they have a history of asthma themselves. So that could be a genetic factor there. Mother's antibiotic exposure, again, that would directly affect our gut health, causing like dysbiosis, potentially leaky gut. And a big thing too, as we briefly mentioned earlier, our diets. So the American diet is called the SAD diet, the standard American diet. It's a lot of processed foods, junk foods, fillers that are not good for our gut health. And there are fats, but they're actually not good fats. They're very inflammatory fats. So those really can contribute also to, you know, inflammatory oils like canola oil, vegetable oil, palm oil is a big one that can affect gut health. And one of my gripes, which this can be a total rabbit hole to go down with a formula, but a lot of baby formulas in America have palm oil in them as, you know, like a main ingredient. And I breastfed my first child for 6 months and then I gave her formula. But then when I had my twins, I was dead set on not giving them formula. So I actually was able to pump and store some, and they got breast milk for their first 12 months of their life because I was so appalled at the palm oil. I could not find a formula that I was happy with. So I think that mothers are eating these inflammatory foods, but then also if we do have to give babies formula or even supplement, we're already causing insult to their guts by introducing that. And then things that actually decrease the rate of asthma in kids would be a high fiber diet in the mom. And we're going to talk about that later too, is like the benefits of fiber in the colon and how it actually can help lower our immune responses, and vitamin D supplementation during pregnancy. So low vitamin D levels are a chronic problem in this country. They're very important to get it checked, especially to low vitamin D levels have also been linked to, say, miscarriages and difficulty getting pregnant. So I think that is a very important level for women to get checked during childbearing ages, especially if they're planning on getting pregnant. and then also to knowing their vitamin D levels during pregnancy. Stress, we talked about stress, how that can affect our gut health extremely. So, you know, if the mother is stressed, there's so many cascades like inflammation and affecting the gut health that can also contribute to allergies in the babies. And also we find that maternal age and geographic locations can also be higher rates of allergy, but maybe to me, Asia is a big area. So that could be like the industrialization. So maybe they have like higher rates of pollution, because I wanted to mention it earlier and I didn't get a chance to, but we talk about toxins so much, and I think people kind of take it for granted. Like you mentioned, Dr. Burdette, the parts per million in the air, but the first actual documentation of a seasonal allergy was in the United Kingdom in the industrial era. So like that was the first documented case in medical literature. And that just goes to show the pollution in the air from the new factories. And yeah, we might not live near factories here for some people, but our air quality is not the same.
Absolutely. And I think you make an important point. Sometimes people can't breastfeed, and there are plenty of people, babies that do formula and are just fine. So it doesn't need to be one more thing for a mom to stress about. But to say that formula is identical to breast milk just isn't true. In addition to, like I already mentioned, diamine oxidase being passed in breast milk, you won't find that in formula. Thyroid hormone is passed in breast milk. Melatonin, the one that makes us sleep, is passed in breast milk. So there are a lot of things that help set up a normal, healthy system that are passed in breast milk that we're just not going to see in formula. So there's a lot of reasons that that can be so useful in terms of helping to get somebody on the right track if it's possible to do so.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even like consumption of artificial sweeteners during pregnancy has been linked to development of asthma. And certainly there's increasing artificial sweeteners. And even I think there's probably still data we don't know about, like stevia and monk fruit and how those impact the microbiome. I think there's some question on, does stevia in this process form have an impact there? But probably not as much as those other like sucralose and other things, but really just thinking about what we're eating, putting in our system, and how that's impacting our microbes. So diets that are really,
you mentioned that. Yeah. That fiber part. And I think that it ties into these artificial sweeteners, because one of the things that we know is that those so the reason that we want fiber is because when your good, healthy flora sees fiber, it chews it up and it makes these things called short chain fatty acids. And those are go-to building blocks to make sure the gut isn't leaky, to even make sure vessels in the brain, the blood-brain barrier isn't leaky. But more pertinent to this conversation is that gut-based piece. And so when people eat a lot of those artificial sweeteners, it decreases production of butyrate, one of our main short chain fatty acids. It kills off the microbiome. And so ironically, diet drinks are still linked, for example, to diabetes, mm-hmm. because those short-chain fatty acids that are made from fiber decrease our risk of diabetes. Well, now you're not getting diabetes per se exactly from the sugar, but you're killing off something that's protective. And so it's one more way to get there. So it's important to be mindful of how those affect our microbiome.
For sure. Short chain fatty acids, it's fascinating. So I do a lot of diabetes care and started over the last like 4 or 5 years really doing gut testing and helping the patients with the microbiome component. And it makes such a huge impact and we know even like these short chain fatty acids have this effect on other hormones like GLP-1 that are responsible for telling our pancreas to make insulin and telling our liver to stop making too much sugar, telling our brain we're full. All of those pieces, the satiety feeling after you eat, is all this metabolic response that so much of it starts in the gut that we can almost say that the gut is part of the endocrine system. There's so much there. So the short chain fatty acids can be tested on, for those of you that aren't familiar, can be tested on stool tests. So we can get a stool test, a stool sample. We can see how someone's short chain fatty acids look and what the metabolites look like, which can give us a really great picture, you know, regardless of what pathogen or other things show up there. It can really help us understand how to support the microbiome for that person. Certainly we can supplement butyrate. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but it's not fixing the underlying issue of the fact that we need the short chain fatty acids and the diverse in the microbiome.
pull us out of a crisis, and there's good data with it. Unfortunately, yeah. Most butyrate supplements don't taste that great.
So they can be I can't get past the smell when you open the bottle. I'm like, okay, never mind.
Yeah. And so since our good healthy flora plus fiber, I mean, you know, I'm just a huge fan of like chia seed pudding. Yeah. All you have to do is just your chia seeds. And I like macadamia milk and then maybe a little vanilla and not too much sweetener, but maybe a little monk fruit, something like that. And it clumps up and it makes a nice, very filling snack, but just grams of fiber there. And I challenge everybody who is listening. I really want you to track your fiber for the next 3 to 5 days. You will be shocked at how little you really get. Like I am a very good, I feel like I do not eat a standard American diet. I even have vegetables at breakfast. And so I work them into every single meal. And when I really started to track those actual grams of daily fiber, I was like, 6 to 9, maybe 12, but 15 to 30 is really better. And so you've got to put some conscious effort into getting it. And I know fiber doesn't sound sexy, but try to call it a short chain fatty acid because that makes it sound sexier. And that's what happens when the flora chews it up. And those short chain fatty acids, they reduce incidence of autoimmunity. Propionate does that. And butyrate decreases not only colon cancer, but prostate cancer and breast cancer, because what happens in the gut decreases inflammation in the rest of the body. And so they're anti-inflammatory systemically as well. And so another thing that those short chain fatty acids do is they build what are called tight junctions. And those are the things that link our gut back together. So when we're talking about reducing leaky gut, fiber is a critical component to that. And you even see some argue may possibly more important than probiotics. A lot of people are saying you can see a greater shift by increasing your fiber, because when you think about it, if there are, again, more bacteria in our gut than stars in the Milky Way, you know, taking a capsule, some people will say, is a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. And mathematically, numerically speaking, that's true. I do think that that's not the whole story, though. Sure. When you take those things, you're often influencing your body's own microbiome to recover. Mm-hmm. So there's that piece as well. But to overlook the fiber is really a mistake, because that's the go-to for those short-chain fatty acids. Higher short-chain fatty acids reduce things like allergies, autoimmunity, that atopic branch of the immune system, that's allergies, eczema, asthma. And so we've mentioned it, when you put that barrier in place, now you don't have all these things irritating the immune system. And so when the gut's leaky, these things leak in and they irritate what are called naive T cells. And the naive T cells, they're waiting. They're kind of saying, okay, who's going to invade? What are we going to see? And then I'm going to specialize and I'm going to fight that. Well, when the food begins to leak through intact, those naive T cells go, that's it. We better start fighting this. And so they begin to make antibodies to that food instead of being on reserve to fight that first infection. And so now that immune confusion, you fight the food, you make higher levels of antibodies, and this pushes what's called a Th2 response. So I think of it like a seesaw, and we want to be in balance. We want our innate immune system to be present. But when Th2 goes up, our innate immune system goes down, and now we don't fight infections as well. So on one hand, you're like, I have this overactive part of the immune system giving me allergies, but yet on the other hand, I don't fight infections as well because this part of the immune system is down. And so one of the things that a good gut health does is it blocks those T cells from being activated. Another thing it does is it builds that healthy microbiome that sends signals to the T cells to say, hey, everything's fine. Stay calm, stay cool. We don't need to be overly reacting to things in the environment. And so it's the beginning of keeping that immune system in place. And it kind of ties us back to breast milk again. One of the things that's high in breast milk is something called IL-10. And this tells the immune system, okay, there's a cell in the middle. These are our Treg cells. Put it in balance. So it increases these Treg cells to keep us in balance. IL-10 is the thing that says, don't react to this. This is normal. Stay where you're at. Well, other things that increase IL-10, like the IL-10 in breast milk, a couple things we've talked about already. Probiotics, fish oil. And so when we're looking at those guys, another part of that mechanism of action is that they mimic what breast milk is doing, telling us, hey, calm down, don't be as reactive to these substances.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you ever use plant sterols like therapeutically, like the Moducare products? I know there's like a trademarked product that a couple different companies make that has specific plant sterols that are apparently shown to help balance this TH1, TH2 response. Have you seen that to be beneficial, or do you work more with food?
I've used them a little bit. They haven't been home runs for me all the time. I find treating the gut, doing things to decrease leaky gut to be more helpful,
sure.
Higher on my list, often just giving some diamine oxidase from people who are in a crisis with either food sensitivities or allergies that will immediately lower that histaminergic burden. And then we want to think about, okay, why are those cells that release histamine being activated? Again, one big reason is leaky gut. We work on that. But the other reason is, are they fragile and breaking down easily? And so things that will build the membrane. So a mast cell is one that bursts open and releases histamine. Things that build the membrane of the mast cell, like I mentioned, those omega-3 fatty acids that are found in fish oil. Quercetin does that as well. Quercetin is a flavonoid. It is what gives yellow onions that yellow color. So it's in garlic and onions. You also see it in fruits like kiwi that get touted for good GI health. So there's a lot of places that quercetin comes from. Quercetin has been compared to, for example, there's a medication called Cromolyn that's designed to deal with overproduction of histamine in the gut. And so when compared to Cromolyn, you've seen roughly similar outcomes. And that's nice because quercetin is also an antioxidant. We learned a lot about quercetin over the past 2 years. It's what's called an ionophore, meaning that it gets more zinc into the cell. And if you want zinc to be on board to fight infections, you got to get it into the cell to do it. So quercetin is one of the things that leads it to that spot. It's a go-to just as a general anti-inflammatory for the gut. If someone is having gut pain, quercetin will often calm that down. And so for me, that one is more of a home run in terms of reducing that histaminergic burden.
Yeah.
Apple skins too have a lot of quercetin in them.
Apples, is that what you said?
Skin of apples.
Yes, skin of apples. Don't peel those apples for those kiddos. It's hard because they're like so waxy. Even like the organic apples, you're like, how do I get this wax off so I can eat this skin? I soak them in vinegar and baking soda a little bit, but then they don't last as long in the fridge. So you got to like balance that about, do it right before you're going to eat them. Yes, lots of foods have that. Have you had any experiences? So I have come across some information, and one of the speakers at a recent A-Forum conference that I went to was talking about quercetin inhibiting COMT or CMT metabolism. And so people that are already slow COMT metabolite, like their COMT is slow, so they have slow activity of these catecholamines or getting rid of these like norepi and epinephrine. When they take so much, if they take a certain amount of quercetin, it can cause them to like feel like this adrenaline thing or this anxiousness. Have you experienced that with your patients?
That is theoretically true, but COMT is very difficult to budge. So while in an assay, it might have a minimal binding affinity, it's theoretically true, but the amount that it does that is really negligible. So yes, you'll see that listed on tables, but how that plays out in the body isn't really...
Because I found with myself that it seems like it, but maybe it's like, because some days I would take dehist and some days I wouldn't. And then it was like, well, some days I had this like anxious feeling. And so I don't know if it was that combined with the other things in the product or something else in the product. But then when that, I want to say it was Jill Carnahan had mentioned that at the conference, and I was like, oh my goodness, that might be my problem.
Yes, it's a very hard enzyme to actually
Well, that's interesting. Maybe I'll have to try it again in smaller amounts.
Yeah.
I've seen it in smaller amounts in some of like gut restore products and different things that might be good. Well, just in summary, I know we've been talking for about 45 minutes already. I can't believe it. But what do we do about this? So all of these things lead up to the development of allergies. And a lot of it is coming back to that gut health. So we in functional medicine and naturopathic medicine have this 4-hour, 5-hour protocol where we talk about removing some of those foods that are really triggering the body. And our goal is not to remove them forever, especially when these IgG or these like low grade responses. We want to remove them so our body calms down that inflammation, lets the gut heal, and then we are able to reintroduce them hopefully later. And then also, so we talked a little bit about stool testing, but looking at, there are certain bugs like Citrobacter species and other things that can create excess histamine. And so when we're thinking about balancing the microbiome, trying to target some of those bugs that are creating the excess histamine might be part of some a practitioner's plan to help reduce allergies. And then the stress component, we talk about stress every podcast. I say, if we don't talk about stress on this podcast, we didn't do our job, right? There's so many extra stressors, and getting really into that rest and digest, like Dr. Burdette mentioned, is so important for balancing the microbiome, because otherwise we're not going to digest our food properly. The microbiome is going to shift. I've mentioned before, there's studies that people just who have been in the ICU have a drastically shifted microbiome, despite the fact if they were on antibiotics or not during that time. So much information about how stress affects the microbiome. And then toxic exposure. So we're removing all of those things at the beginning, but we're also potentially replacing digestive enzymes. Maybe we're supporting, you know, apple cider vinegar or some kind of support for the digestive system. We re-inoculate, so that re-inoculation process means we give dietary changes. So we give the food for the microbiome and the fiber we talked so much about. We do sometimes, as practitioners, recommend some supplemental fiber if someone can't get it from the diet. But the reason we wanted you to get it from the diet is that the more diverse types of fiber that you get, the more diverse our microbiome is going to be. And if you're just scooping in the same fiber every day, that's going to be less of a diverse support for the microbiome. And then the probiotics and prebiotics might depend on what your gut flora looked like and your practitioner's experience with things that modulate. There's the strains we talked about, like the Lactobacillus acidophilus and other Lactobacillus strains like Planetarium, that are great for the women's flora type strains in the vaginal, preventing the yeast infections, like we mentioned. But certainly there's other data for spore probiotics and other things that actually can have more of effective, you know, helping to help the microbiome to flourish and change. And then the inflammation, we talked a lot about inflammation today. So reducing the inflammation, using nutrients that are going to support the GI tract cells, some of those being omega-3 fatty acids, colostrum, glutamine, maybe a little bit, but really that the fiber component has a big impact there with that inflammation and immune signaling that we mentioned with the short chain fatty acids. And sometimes this R is left off, but the rebalance R is so important, because we need to make sure we're getting the body back balanced and looking at mindfulness, you know, things like yoga, biofeedback, acupuncture, that are going to help us to really balance that stress so we don't get ourselves in the same position again. I know we've talked a little bit about most of the other things we have on our outline here, but Mediterranean diet is always a great place to go back to when we're talking about decrease in inflammation. And there's studies saying that decreases asthma risk. It's lots of high in antioxidants. It's long chain omega-3 fatty acids in the olive oil and fish. So any other dietary things that you guys would add in for patients with allergies?
Yeah. So I just think sometimes it can be hard. We've mentioned some particular foods, but the lab that I'm co-founder and educational director of, Precision Point Diagnostics, that's really what we got started around, was food allergy and environmental testing, so that you can figure out what your body is reacting to rather than just kind of guessing at these things. And we also do stool testing. And so sometimes that diagnostic piece can be useful.
Yeah. So you want to talk about that as we close out a little bit, like about what you feel like the, if someone's coming to a practitioner, so they're coming to one of our farm table practitioners and saying, I have allergies and my gut's impacted potentially, like what would be like the testing that you would recommend that you guys do? And what are the big key components that we're looking for on there?
Well, I think those are the big two. I think that you think about what's irritating the gut, and that's either going to be a food or a bug. And so between the food testing and the stool testing, those are really going to get you to, okay, what's going on in this ecosystem? Mm-hmm. Then when you remove foods that one is allergic to, it also helps the microbiome to take over. So those are a really nice one too, when we're getting to gut-based health.
Awesome. Awesome. And then what would you say that Precision Point does differently, or like that you feel like is like the reason that that is a really strong test to do for our patients?
It's the only test that looks at four independent ways that the body can react to food. So, of course, we can have allergies, and that's immediate reaction. Your lips swell, you cough, you itch, something happens immediately, even anaphylactic shock and going to the emergency room. However, when people react to foods, an IgE antibody, an allergy, is only positive 50% of the time at best. So we know allergies alone miss 50% of what's going on. The second thing we look at is IgG. Those are your food sensitivities. So most of the time you'll do one test or the other. We look at both. Is there an immediate reaction? Is there a delayed reaction 3 to 72 hours later? Some people will say, well, I don't know about IgG because there's actually four types of IgG and one type is very different than the other three. IgG subtype 4, it doesn't create inflammation. It doesn't bind to complement. It doesn't drive food sensitivities. And in fact, it can block IgE from binding to basophils or our mast cells to release histamine. It's actually the one that goes up when we're doing desensitization therapies. So it can even be good. So we tease out IgG4, we measure that separately. And if you have more IgG4 than IgE, it will block that allergic reaction. So you're getting a pretty important part of the clinical picture by looking at it that way. So IgE, IgG4, IgG total. Then we also look at complement. Complement can bind to IgG and amplify that reaction 1,000 to 10,000-fold. So sometimes you'll do food sensitivity testing with IgG and your patient will go, oh, but it's this moderate one that always gives me the headache, not this one that's high. Well, a moderate IgG titer, but with complement present, again, can amplify that reaction 1,000-fold. So looking at these immune pieces together really puts the puzzle together because, as we know, it's an immune system. Mm-hmm. And so looking at the system together rather than an isolated part gives a much clearer clinical picture of what's happening.
Yeah, that's really helpful because when you just look at the high here, that's like a completely different report than if you have that information to say, oh, well, my IgG for dairy is high, but this IgG4 piece is blocking and I'm fine. Then maybe I don't have to make this drastic dietary change to really improve my symptoms. Like I thought I had to make this 20 food removal process.
Absolutely. And then we do a few other things to really hone in on the clinical picture. Like we give a couple diets, one that's more restrictive, one that's less restrictive. We also look to see, okay, of the foods that you're reactive to, were they high FODMAP foods? Were they high histamine foods? And then we pull out those patterns. We look at salicylates, amines, et cetera. And so about 8 different categories there. So you can go, oh, maybe this is an irritant for me as well. Then we give you some good information of, okay, here are the foods you're reactive to. Here are other things in that food family so that you can really look at it from a number of different angles.
Awesome. Well, anything else either of you want to add to our conversation today?
One thing that I always like to tell my patients when Dr. Burdett mentioned like challenge yourself with fiber, I always like to challenge patients, like try to eat the rainbow. And then once they kind of get the rainbow down, like, okay, yeah, I've my red through purple, white, brown foods. I tell you, okay, well, this next coming week, try to eat 30 different fruits or vegetables. And they're sometimes like, they feel very intimidated by the number 30, but once they're comfortable with incorporating fruits and especially vegetables through every meal, it's easier said than, it's actually much easier than they think it is.
Right.
That's a great challenge.
Yeah. And just reframing like what we have for breakfast, I think like sometimes we think we have to have this pastry or simple whatever it is, like muffin or something like that, cereal, but you can eat like your dinner that you had the night before for breakfast as leftovers. And you can eat, sometimes I'll eat soup for breakfast, especially in the winter to have something warm in the morning, because my go-to in the summers is smoothies with veggies. But in the winter, you drink that smoothie on the way to work and you're like freezing. But so
eggs with spinach and mushrooms,
yes,
on the side.
Exactly,
one of my
exactly.
very favorite
yes.
is I'll roast butternut squash or whatever squash mm-hmm. you have. Do that before. So that's done. And then it's not hot. And in the morning, just scoop it out. Mm-hmm. And I'll put a little paleo flour with that and an egg in there. And then I make little, basically they look like latkes, you know?
Yeah.
And then if you want to, if you're not sensitive to dairy, a little dollop of Greek yogurt on top is nice there too. So there are ways to do it that can still.
Yes. Yeah. Still feel like the, you know, special treat breakfast, but make it full of veggies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's lots of ways to incorporate veggies. I need to figure out, I know I'll have to look, if you have a recipe for that, you'll have to let me know. We can post it, but like trying to find ways to get my kids to eat more veggies in their meals throughout the day would be helpful because it's a struggle. I'm on a struggle bus with the 5-year-old right now.
Start your day savory. I heard it somewhere. I don't know where, but it was start your day savory.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. And that's supposed to be like our most important meal of the day. Like you're supposed to eat the most at breakfast because the rest of your metabolism and those kinds of things. So we need to eat the most of something good and not the most of these refined grain things. So awesome. Well, thank you both for joining today. I really appreciate your time. And I think this information is going to be really helpful to our audience. And if you are one of those patients out there that's struggling with allergies, whether that be seasonal allergies or food sensitivities or gut pain and any of those types of things, please reach out to us and head to our website at farmtotable, farmtotable.life, and click on meet a provider and just click on your state from there and you'll find a provider that can help you in your state. So again, and thank you guys and look forward to connecting again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.